They're very indiscriminate. It doesn't matter whether you're on the right or the left. If you're going against sort of the establishment direction, then you really must be tucked down.
Hello and welcome to The Popular Show with me, as ever, James A. Smith. Absolutely delighted to be joined by Dominique Samuels today. She's a talking head and political commentator here in the UK, often found in the Daily Mail and on GB News. So it's a slight across spectrum political discussion we've got going on. Dominique, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad at all. Absolutely can't complain. I thought we'd start with the stuff that's going to get us banned from YouTube again. You've spent the weekend at a demonstration for those who say they're injured by COVID vaccines. I've not really been seeing much reportage on what looked like a pretty huge protest and demonstration at the weekend in the mainstream. Maybe you could fill us in on what that was all about.
Yeah, so it was a huge gathering on Saturday, just around the corner from the BBC's broadcasting house. There was a police presence around sort of the corner, around the perimeter. So the fact that they, you know, saw fit to obviously have a police presence, but didn't see fit to maybe think that this was worth reporting on, I think is extremely telling indeed. But it was a large gathering of people, really, really large, actually. When we were walking down to Downing Street, where we laid our white roses, you know, it was like filling in the streets, like it was a lot. And there were a host of high profile speakers as well. Obviously, the most important people were those who were vaccine injured and bereaved. But Andrew Bridgen MP, the Conservative MP that's recently been suspended because of his comments on the COVID vaccine, Matt Letizier and Dr. Robert Malone. So it was a very well organised big event. It could be heard from miles around where we were because it was a very professional setup. There was a massive screen, speakers, and it was great. But you know, it was also really harrowing as well to hear all of the stories. And I think what struck me about it just was the fact that, you know, regardless of whether or not you think vaccine injuries are very common, there are still some people that stick to the line of it being incredibly rare, so minute that it doesn't even matter. You know, surely you would be on the side of the people that are saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not 60% disabled, but I can't live my life and I've drained all my savings trying to fix my health. Why am I being ignored and gaslit? And I think that the fact that not enough people are asking those questions or showing that empathy is a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of excess deaths in this country at the moment, and this has been variously explained. The people who are kind of fully unrepentant, still paid up, pro-lockdown, pro-all COVID containment measures, they've sort of moved to arguing that this is a result of long COVID, that there's a lot more long COVID than we realise, and that's what's killing people. There's the argument that this is simply a kind of matter of austerity, that the NHS has continued to be underfunded through the pandemic. And what we're seeing is the result of ambulances just not being able to turn up when people need them. On the other hand, there's the position we've tended to take on this show is that this is a kind of long lockdown effect, that this is people who didn't get treatment that they needed through a lockdown and now seeing that kind of come home to roost. And on top of that, the long kind of physical effects of locking down are still making themselves known, not to mention what Sunetra Gupta has argued on this show and elsewhere, that there is an immunity debt from not having been exposed to stuff. So there's a lot of arguments in the mix. And of course, the argument that unprecedented mass vaccination of adults also may have something to do with it. What's your own view? I mean, you've been speaking on this subject a lot. How important do you think vaccine injuries are as a phenomenon? And why are they being so excluded from the public conversation?
Well, just in terms of the scale, obviously, I can't say this is absolute facts. This is just my opinion based upon the data that I've looked at and recognizing some of the trends. Because that's the thing, a trend is a really important word because, you know, for the people that say, oh, it's austerity, oh, you know, it's that. Well, look, all over the world, these excess deaths are occurring all over the world. This is a global health emergency, I'd say, at a scale of which we haven't really seen. You know, it makes the deaths that we incurred through COVID and during the pandemic look minuscule, actually, in comparison to what's happening. I was watching a video this morning by Dr. John Campbell, and he was just looking at the deaths of actually young adults, and they're up, I think, 7.8% since 2019. So that's thousands and thousands of people dying. Yeah. That's a problem. And when we look at sort of vaccine injuries and reports that have been logged, all of the global, you know, reporting of it, there has been collectively more reports for these COVID-19 vaccines than any other vaccine. And, you know, other vaccines have been suspended for less. So I think that's a really important question. I think it's a mix of the two, though. I think that we knew that lockdowns would kill more people than they would save, just because of the logic of actually locking people in their homes, locking down society, locking them at home with their abusers for children in particular. That would have an impact. So I think it's definitely half and half. I think that we should be careful, though, not to write off the vaccine and just say it's just lockdown, because I think it may definitely have a role to play. But we won't know unless it's properly independently investigated. And that's something that's just not happening.
The American CDC is now investigating the correlation of the vaccines with strokes and heart attacks. I mean, to be honest, I think quite a lot of people, quite a lot of educated liberal people in particular, have got sort of sunk costs with this. So I rather suspect that even if the criticisms of vaccines turn out to have more truth in them than has been allowed in the mainstream thus far, I've got a feeling that that's not going to, there's a lot of people that's not going to change their minds, because, you know?
Yeah, because there's a question here of the role that these people played for the past 2 years, and that role was muddying the waters between informed and uninformed consent. Mm-hmm. And millions of people have gotten these injections believing that there was no risk. Let's be honest here. Any risk that was suggested, we just didn't know, because there was no long-term safety data, because these were licensed under emergency use. That is a fact that nobody wants to talk about either. These pharmaceutical companies were given legal indemnity, meaning they could not be held accountable. And nurses in the NHS, I recently found out that they were given legal indemnity as well for administering these vaccines. So nobody can really be held accountable. You're telling people that these 100 are 100% safe, 100% effective. That means millions of people are getting them without realizing. Whether or not you want to, you know, measure up the cost benefit, I think that's a personal choice that people should make, but they should be able to make that choice. And they weren't. And that, you know, begs the question of, are certain people within the medical profession and within our government responsible for the injuring and unfortunately killing of some people because of the propaganda that they pushed? That's a really important question. And that's probably why we all were, you know, they want to deny, they want to distract, and they want to gaslight.
It was evident right from the start that a huge number of people that this vaccine has been pushed on didn't necessarily need it. Maybe they benefit from it, maybe they wouldn't, but they didn't need it. Mm-hmm. And to have across the world vaccine mandates, to have at least limitations on what people could do socially if they didn't get vaccinated in parts of Britain and even some in England, which has been the most libertarian of all places here. To force and to pressure people in that way was just from the start, even if all of this stuff about vaccine injuries turns out to be overblown. Even if that's the case, it was already completely unjustified. And that's before we get on to the sheer level of censorship that we've seen on this. The rollout of the COVID vaccine has been totally unprecedented in its scale. The vaccines themselves were totally new. Everything about this was novel and untested territory. And in a democracy, we should have been allowed to talk about it. We should have been allowed to argue about it without constantly worrying about getting kicked off social media platforms, constantly worrying that we're going to be humiliated and discredited in public. I just value the position you've taken and the work that you've been doing, and even value a platform that I wasn't terribly impressed with when it was announced, GB News, for kind of keeping this sort of critique in the mainstream, really. Let's get on to Andrew Bridgen, whose situation you have picked up. Maybe you could just explain, particularly for international listeners, maybe you could explain what went on with this MP.
Yeah, so Andrew Bridgen is a high-profile Conservative MP. Obviously, the Conservatives are in government in the UK at the moment. And he has been one of the first MPs. There were two others that have been quite prominent. There's Christopher Chope MP and Danny Kruger MP. These three MPs, you know, attended an APPG that I was at Parliament, actually, that was hosted by Dr. Naseem Malhotra, a really famous cardiologist at the moment that is currently asking for the mRNA jabs to be suspended pending an independent investigation. But, you know, Andrew Bridgen, Christopher Chope, Danny Kruger were there, and they were listening to people that had actually arrived at this event who were vaccine injured. And obviously they listened to the evidence, the medical evidence that Dr. Naseem Malhotra presented. Since then, I actually spoke and I said to them, I said, because, you know, we were quite frustrated that there were only three MPs had shown up to this event in Westminster, all of them Conservative, no Labour MPs. And I was saying, it's okay to do speeches in Parliament, okay, but most people are not going to be seeing those speeches. What we need to see is you guys speaking out on social media and actually giving this evidence, because that's the only way that what you're saying is actually going to get recognised. And then after that, I mean, I'm not saying I'm responsible for it, but I did say this. And after that, Andrew Bridgen took to online to Twitter and actually began posting. And since then, we've got a massive conversation that's occurring in the mainstream about the safety of the vaccines and obviously the harms of the vaccines, the injuries that they've caused. But Andrew Bridgen made the mistake of, you know, using the word Holocaust. And in this country and all over the West, really, any, you know, mention or comparison, you know, with the Holocaust and things like that, it's automatically... anti-Semitism, you can't say that. So, you know, it was a very...
I'll give the actual quotation. The tweet said, as one consultant cardiologist said to me, this is the biggest crime against humanity since the Holocaust. That's the actual citation.
Yeah, and that was the quote itself. He was quoting somebody else and actually quoting an Israeli professor that, you know, lives in Israel, in Jerusalem, working at a university. But the media jumped on that. It was anti-Semitic, blah, blah, blah. So the Conservative Party actually suspended him. So he's become sort of a hero for many people, because he's one of the few elected representatives that, regardless of, you know, whatever you think his stance is on the COVID vaccines, whether you think it's right or wrong, you can at least admit that he's one representative that cares more about saying what he believes to be true and representing the people of this country than he does his career. So for many people, he's been a shining light, and it was amazing to see him speaking at the march on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, I myself have no investment in Andrew Bridgen's reputation, and I mean hitherto the guy's just been a sort of standard crooked Tory for me. He was already under investigation for dodgy donations, but what I will say is that Tory MPs, backbench Tory MPs, have always said all kinds of things, all kinds of perhaps crankish things, and have been allowed to get away with it. It's part of the family brand, if you like, that, that this is what our backbenchers do. They explore these sometimes fringe ideas, and sometimes something will take hold and become policy, etc. So it is actually quite unusual. I think Andrew Bridgen would have been within his rights to think that he was at liberty to say things like this in mm-hmm. the Conservative Party. It is quite novel, actually, that somebody would lose the whip, be kicked out of the party, as it hasn't quite happened yet, but I gather that's what is in the pipeline for him.
Yeah, because he was, I think he was, I can't remember the exact terminology, but I think he was like under investigation for something else, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can't remember exactly. He was under investigation, something to do with something he did that wasn't procedural, but this was whilst he was actually speaking out. So there was that, and then many people found that suspicious. That he was under investigation, I think suspended. And then there was this where he loses the whip.
I see. Are you suggesting that he was being investigated for the financial stuff because of what he was saying? Like, well, come on, we all cheat out the nation.
I mean, I don't know. Like whether or not it's true, but many people found the correlation.
Yeah,
suspicious.
I see what you mean. Yeah,
they found it suspicious.
Well, okay, but let me put it this way. I've thought all the way through this this kind of COVID ordeal. I felt that we have seen a new refusal of democratic debate about hugely important things. We've seen a new willingness on the part of the state and the powerful to kind of cut off inconvenient people and to ruin their reputations very, very swiftly. And watching all this, I felt like I was seeing deployed discursive technologies that were invented to get rid of Corbyn. I feel like I've seen right wingers get cut down one after another. Boris himself, I thought that was absolutely the playbook that was used against Jeremy Corbyn, used against the guy who was got in to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. I put it to you and your audience on the right that quite a lot that was tolerated about the way that Corbyn was like dismantled and his reputation was destroyed, quite a lot about that was cheered on by the right, naturally enough at the time, has since been used in all kinds of other areas. And I think this Andrew Bridgen thing is a pretty neat example that, I don't know, was it the case that you couldn't ever mention the Holocaust as a comparison to mean really, really bad until relatively recently? I feel like people have seen how well it worked with Corbyn, that they've started using it in other areas. I wonder what you make of that comparison.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you actually mentioned that, because the pandemic has sort of made me fundamentally change the way I looked at things, mm-hmm. even in regards to Jeremy Corbyn, to be honest. Once the sort of glasses were off and I was in the midst of this, you know, basically mass like brainwashing campaign, which is the way mm-hmm. I saw it. I witnessed this, I saw the headlines, and it made me think, in what other areas have you actually deployed this arsenal? And I was thinking, actually, it was similar with Jeremy Corbyn. It was almost like a uniform, this guy cannot get into office. And it was like across all media platforms. It was just extremely uniform. You know, he's an anti-Semite, he's an anti-Semite, he's an anti-Semite. That was what was being drilled and drilled and drilled. And then Jeremy Corbyn's replacement, Keir Starmer, comes out and says he'd prefer to be in Davos than in Westminster, and would prefer to sit next to Piers Morgan than Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah. A guy that was actually in his own party, and at one point he was fine with this guy being made Prime Minister. And I think, and it really does make you think. So yeah, I agree. I think that same media arsenal that, you know, is used to destroy people like Jeremy Corbyn, used to promote lockdowns, used to demonize people that are actually speaking out against the tyranny, to be honest, they're very indiscriminate. It doesn't matter whether you're on the right or the left. If you're going against sort of the establishment direction, then you really must be tucked down. And I think probably, I mean, I don't really explicitly refer to myself as right wing anymore. Mm-hmm. I think that once you apply labels to yourself, you can, not only are people from the outside trying to put you in a box, I think you subconsciously also put yourself into a box and sort of close off other ways of thinking. Even with the strikes, like, I'm actually for the strikes. I think that, you know, people have gotten a really rough deal. But for a while, I didn't, my sort of heart was saying, actually, I think these guys have got a point. But then yeah. the box was saying, oh, no, you can't. So, yeah, I do. I see the correlation. And I think probably a lot of people that were on my side of the aisle or really didn't like Jeremy Corbyn have probably seen it as well. I personally know of people that think that now anyway.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting to hear. I mean, another aspect of it has been people pretending that they didn't historically think things in order to be on the right team about the present thing. Like, so many people who had criticised private health companies, so many people who had criticised ID cards and all kinds of illiberal measures in the past, people who had even specifically, you know, ruled out the idea of lockdowns. Suddenly in 2020, they're for all those things when it comes to COVID. It was very similar with Corbyn. People who had historically, you know, had very similar criticisms of Israel, for example, like, suddenly they're acting like offended maiden aunts at the very idea. I mean, you know, back in the day, The Guardian was always targeted with the very same accusations of being anti-Semitic, and then suddenly it was leading the charge on calling Corbyn. So I really appreciate you saying that about how COVID has made you kind of reassess the political binary, as I think it has really for lots of us. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it was kind of a disaster, really, that you had lockdown and you had people on the right very often being more critical of it than people on the left. I think that was extremely unfortunate. But then you also had, like, as well as this one hugely illiberal measure that Boris Johnson's government was bringing in and running, you had a whole suite of other ones, including the online safety bill, which is still being worked out now. You saw huge revolutionary measures in protecting the police and the military from investigation and from prosecution for crimes. So and the left hated that, but the right wasn't so bothered about it. So it seems like so important to see this as all one thing. The government that can bring in lockdowns is also the government that can police you online, can protect its own, turn the police into its own security force, and, as Rishi Sunak is continuing the project, can massively expand Britain's already incredibly limiting anti-strike laws. So, I mean, flashback to 2019, wasn't Boris Johnson supposed to be the libertarian choice? How have we got to this stage in the interim?
Oh, that's such a good question. Even with the comment that you made about Boris Johnson, he said, I think famously, that if he was asked to show his ID card, he'd stuff it in his mouth and eat it. And next thing you know, his government and people like Nadeem Zahawi are trying to justify vaccine passports. Yeah. And Boris Johnson saying that we needed a conversation about it. It really does boggle the mind how people's principles can really just go out of the window. And it's the same with the other issues with regards to tightening strike laws, online safety bill, even the legislation on protests. And I think that, again, the media has a really big role to play in that, because I'm suspicious of Extinction Rebellion, and I'm suspicious of Just Stop Oil in terms of how they're able to organise so professionally, and actually why they get back-to-back media coverage all across the board. Something smells fishy to me about that. I think, again, it's to condition public opinion to think, actually, yeah, we do need limitations on what we can do when we protest. Actually, we do need this because, I mean, look at all of these groups like Extinction Rebellion, like Just Stop Oil. They're completely crazy. They're blocking roads. They're blocking ambulances. Like, we need to do something. So when you take that situation and you view it in isolation, you do actually end up blindly voting for more of your freedoms and your rights being taken away. Same with the strikes. Media is uniform in demonizing the strikes, making it about sort of Marxism versus capitalism, like Mick Lynch's The Marxist Guy It's Coming to Take Christmas from You. And people are like, I support this legislation because they want to take us back to the 1970s. They want to take us back to the winter of discontent where the country was a complete mess, despite the two contexts being completely different. So yeah, actually, I agree with you taking away my right to actually protest when I'm not getting the rights, my human rights, when I'm at work. So the media plays a role in sort of conditioning these two opposing sides, when actually we are all one and actually our interests are actually all connected. I think the media is the thing that sort of conditions it by making people believe that all of these issues are separate when they're actually all one. Lockdowns, the censorship through the online safety bill, limiting our right to protest, limiting our right to strike when, you know, the government is not paying us enough, quite frankly, for public sector workers. So it's all part of the same thing. But yeah, people cannot see it. But again, they're conditioned to view it as all separate when it's not.
When GB News was announced, it was publicised as Rupert Murdoch trying to bring the Fox News model of hyper-partisan right-wing broadcast media to Britain. Given what you said about the media's responsibility for this kind of malign polarization that is keeping us all in our boxes, how did you feel about sort of going to work with them or becoming a regular with them? And do you think that characterization was fair?
So with GB News, people associate with Murdoch, but News UK is Murdoch. GB News is not anything to do with Rupert Murdoch. Actually, Talk TV, which is very, very slickly produced, and they touch upon all the topics that you'd suspect. Not really any interest in sort of the vaccine, talking about the vaccine or the injuries on there. I don't know why. You can make your own assumptions with that. But with GB News, I was really excited about GB News because I felt as though it gave people like me a voice to actually say what I wanted to say without me having to debate the person that they brought on to debate me and two of the presenters. So it's always like three against one whenever I'm on TV. So in that way, I was really, really happy about it. But even though I love GB News and it is, I think, is a needed alternative, I will still stand by the fact that we cannot rely on any one politician or any one media company to represent us. We have to be independent and rely on ourselves and, you know, us as individuals. So although I think media companies like GB News are important, it can't be the be-all and end-all. We can't get sucked into that sort of loop because that's just being brainwashed just by, you know, a different side.
You started out on the right, and I accept what you said about a lot of issues that have come up since COVID, principal among them having given you pause about that identification and that tribalism. From what I've seen you saying elsewhere, I'm guessing the Ukraine war is also another sort of big thing that makes you feel like you don't really fit into either box right now.
Yeah, because on all the important issues, the right and left are just in bed with each other.
Mm-hmm, really. I accept that. I'm just wondering about how you see your own generation. You're a Gen Z commentator, we hear a lot about Generation Left. We hear a lot about how young people are continuing to vote for left-wing parties and to support left-wing ideas much later in life than any previous generation has. And the usual argument given is that just comes down to property. If you can't buy a house, then you no longer really feel like you've got a stake in the status quo, and that's kind of radicalizing young people. I wonder if you think that's true, and I wonder how you see your own kind of set of preoccupations and beliefs and political priorities in relationship to other, what is basically the majority of other people your age.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one with my generation because I'm frustrated with them in the sense that, you know, we've gone full throttle with the woke identity politics. And I think what it does is it's used to compensate the fact that we don't feel like we have a stake in our society, I'd say. I think the wokeism, the, you know, obsession with non-binary and transgender issues, I think is almost a cover, because I do think for young people, we don't feel like we have a stake in our society. I think we're recognizing, and even I'm recognizing, that for a lot of people, work actually doesn't pay anymore. In fact, you know, prices are getting higher, inflation's getting higher, and we're actually receiving less in return. You can barely afford to rent. you can't buy your own home. You know, your wages are smaller and smaller in comparison to the other costs that you've got to cover. And many people just think, what is the actual point? So I sympathize with my generation with that. I don't believe this narrative that we're all just lazy, work shy, entitled. A lot of us are, but at the same time, I think, you know, a large part of that, you know, goes back to the government, you know, making it impossible for us to own our own home, making it impossible even for us to, some of us that want to settle down and become stay-at-home mums. Now, you know, childcare costs are so expensive, you're basically punished for having a child nowadays. It's completely ridiculous. But at the same time, one thing I can't reconcile with, as I was saying before, is just the wokeism, the identity politics. I think it's a mind virus that eats away. And maybe the social media has a large role to play in this, actually, because I think that's largely responsible for this virus. It does make me feel a bit alienated from a lot of people that are part of my generation, because I don't buy into, I just feel like it's brainwashing. But it is what it is. I mean, I've never really felt like I fit into any particular group at any stage of my life. So,
yeah, I mean, what you say about childcare costs, which, I'm experiencing at the moment. I've felt for a long time that is a real kind of cutting across left, right issue. People on the right say they support the traditional family. Well, there are plenty of people who would love to have a traditional family, but it's literally impossible unless you're mega rich. So, yeah, I mean, socialism for the family seems like a slogan that would piss off and appeal to.
it doesn't have to have these labels. It could just be like, just common sense. It could just be common sense. It doesn't have to be, this is socialist, this is capitalist. Because again, these are all mind viruses that we use to, again, create this illusion that we're all separate from another when we're not. We're all connected. And I'm not perfect. There are some times that I do, you know, slip into that sort of thinking with the box, with the label, because it's a way that we're conditioned to think every single day of our lives. But I think the more people sort of, and I think this is happening for a lot of people, the more people sort of lift that veil and realize that things are beyond what your pronouns are, they're beyond like what political party you voted for. This is really crunch time for humanity right now, I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that does sort of depress me is about the generation left idea is quite how cheaply young people seem to be bought politically. But Bernie and Jeremy did bring this young cohort back into politics and make them feel like they had a stake, and terrified quite a lot of people in doing so. What we've learned from Joe Biden, however, is that those young people are incredibly cheap to buy. It's not that you have to have a plan for meaningfully democratizing the economy like Corbyn did. All you have to do is to appoint one non-binary person to your cabinet and not be the evil right wingers. It is not a happy situation that the most establishment politicians are able to buy that youth vote with such a symbolic kind of set of gestures. And I'm sorry to say that Keir Starmer will do it. He's at the moment trying to you know, buy the boomers off. So he's pretending to not be interested in that. But it'll come round just in time. And I'm sorry to say that I think it'll work. On this program, we're more or less committed to whenever the next election shall be before next year. We're committed to no vote for Starmer on the left. We've seen what happens when the radical left gets behind a neoliberal establishment leader of a left-wing party in order to keep the evil right out. We've seen what happens when that plays out in America, and how completely defeated AOC and Bernie are, and how meaningless those politicians are at best now. I don't want that to happen here, such as the ex-Corbyn left is today. Do you think that there would be an audience for, or people who would listen to an argument that says, look, we on the right gave all for Boris Johnson, and all he did was make this country less free? No one voted for Rishi Sunak. No one wanted him as prime minister. And yet Liz Truss was effectively couped in order to bring him in. Mm. No vote for the Tories on the right. Can you see a similar kind of campaign to try to create clear water between people who are thinking and the party?
Yeah, I see a similar sort of campaign. But I think with traditional Tory voters, they are less disillusioned than Labour voters or those on the left with the current state of our society, far less disillusioned. Yeah. A lot of Tories think that the Conservatives have done a brilliant job, to be honest, that they handled the pandemic fantastically, that the vaccine rollout has been fantastic, that the Ukraine war is fantastic, and they think all of this stuff. So it'll be harder, because also there's this binary that's created where it's, we have to keep voting for this party because it's the least worst option, because the Labour option would be far worse. So that exists on the right as well. But then at the same time, I am really positive, because a lot of people are saying that they'll never vote Tory again. But also a lot of us are looking for alternatives, whether that be the Reform Party, you're probably aware of them, or whether it be sort of UKIP. So there are those sorts of issues as well. I don't know what will happen. I think that definitely the Labour government is the next government, I think, regardless of what happens, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our system is inherently undemocratic, in my view, with our first past the post. So it only will inevitably benefit the two parties. All we can do really is give both of them less of a mandate by perhaps having lower turnout or more short ballots, I think. Or more switching to different parties. I think that's the only real tangible thing that can be measured, unfortunately.
I mean, just since you mentioned the electoral system, I know you've got to bounce, but the that is interesting that you mentioned first past the post as a problem. I mean, it's not something I'm terribly invested in, but a lot of people on the left support proportional representation, support switching electoral system. I rarely hear that discussed on the right, even though there are actually more right-wing minority parties.
Yeah.
So, is that just your idea, or is that sort of conversations you've been having with people?
Well, it's becoming more mainstream now. Reform does support, Reform UK does support reform to our electoral system. Mm-hmm. I think it could be numerous things. It could be proportional representation. It could be sort of the French voting system, where they have rounds, you know, for their presidential elections. It could be something like that. I don't know, but all I know is that, you know, it's not democratic to just have it being a choice between two main parties. And, you know, some people on the right say, well, but that means, you know, you'll have more left-wing representation. And I think that that's democracy. And if you want more seats, work harder, and you will see, you'll see far more diverse representation in terms of the right-wing vote in Parliament, far more with a better voting system. And it's an uncommon argument, yes, but it's an argument that's becoming far more common, because what I don't want to live in is an elected dictatorship, whether that's under a Labour government or under a Conservative government. To me, though, they are one and the same, just few tweaks here and there.
Well, you're one of the very exciting voices that we have in the UK media at the moment, whether people agree with you or disagree. And I'm sure most of our listeners found something to disagree with there and hopefully something to agree with as well. It's been really great speaking to you, and thanks very much for making some time for us on the Popular Show.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.